Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome to another episode. We are on chapter 10, part 8 today, and we've got a full house, which is wonderful. We've got Priyank and Chris and Mike and myself. So last episode, we ended with the reflection that, you know, Guruji had been, you know, living in, it's Calcutta, isn't it? For so long, but never come across his guru. And he was remarking on that. And now we come to the next point in the chapter, where he tells us where he had to go, where he met Sri Yukteswar. And he said, we had to travel for our meeting to the ancient city of Kashi, Banaras. And I was very intrigued as to this town, so I've never been. So I did the classic Lauren and did a lot of Googling. And it's actually a really interesting place. We won't go into it too much because I think we've got this coming up in some later episodes. But it's on the left-hand side of the bank of the Ganges. And apparently it's one of the oldest living cities in the whole world. And people go there as like this pilgrimage spot. And it's said that if you quote-unquote die, or, you know, leave your body there, it's said that you will attain like the ultimate state of freedom from the cycles of birth and re-death. So people actually go there to die, so to speak, and they've got like these special houses where you can, like, you basically have to book a place. It's a whole other world. It's really fascinating. Yeah, and lots of great ones as well walked there. But before we get to that, yeah, Mike.
When Guruji says ancient city, he explained in the beginning of the book that there are many civilizations that were great in the last descending Dwapara Yuga. I love to bring up the Yugas again. And that civilization in India, it outlasted most of the others. He mentioned the peers they had at the time, Babylon and Egypt and Persia. And this is one of the remainders of that civilization. It's an ancient city like this, basically a city that was a pilgrimage spot from the higher ages all the way down. And now we're going up again, and it's always been there, never left.
There's also two important places there, temples, we should say. One of them is the Kashi Vishwanath Temple, which is one of the 12 Jyotirlingas. I hope to go to visit this, by the way, in two days. I should be there. And of course, the other holy place is Lahiri Mahashaya's home.
Indeed, indeed it is. And Guruji does actually say here, he said, hallowed by memories of Lahiri Mahashaya. And I think we'll come to understand why, as we already do in previous chapters, you know. But it got me thinking, because he goes on to say, you know, the Buddha and Shankaracharya, am I saying that correctly?
Shankaracharya. Yeah.
Shankaracharya. Yeah. I always struggle with these pronunciations. But yeah, lots of great ones had walked on that land, all these yogi Christs. And even it was said that Buddha, after he'd attained enlightenment, he did his first sermon in Sarnath, which is basically on the outskirts of Kashi. So it's quite interesting. And then I started thinking about, you know, taking pilgrimages and holy lands. And when I went to the Mother Center earlier this year, they let me go into Guruji's, you know, where he used to live and sleep, in the Mother Center. And it was really special, but they gave me this little card before I went in. And it was basically saying how, you know, the vibrations in these places are so high. And, you know, if you actually meditate deeply in these spots where great ones have been, your realization and your spiritual sort of like what would you say, your spiritual development quickens. So it's very interesting. And then I went on a little spree of reading, and I found, as I often do, and I found this lovely extract from the Divine Romance, I think it is. So, Mike, would you mind reading that out, please?
Also, if you go to a place where masters have lived, the vibrations there will quicken your realization. That is the value of pilgrimages to holy places. When I went to the Holy Land, I felt great inspiration and realization. Jesus incarnated in that troubled land in a time of great difficulties to show that his magnetism could outride every evil. His divine vibrations are still there, just as strong as when he was physically present. Those who are in tune when they go there will feel that presence. But first, one has to meditate and prepare himself. So you can't just go, just book your flight. You have to be in tune first. Yeah. Well, you can't go anyways, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah, I found going, because I'm here in India right now, I've been to two or three of either Sri Yukteswar's or Paramhansa Yogananda's important places like Ranchi and Puri and Serampore. And I just felt that exactly what he's described there with Christ. You know, it's such a powerful place. And as Lauren said about going to see Guruji's home, or rooms in Mother Center, they've you know gone to so much efforts to like preserve everything and keep it exactly as it was, and you just feel that it's just such a beautiful place to go, and all of these places are.
Did you meditate before you went, Priyank, and get in tune purposefully?
Yeah, tried to, and meditated there, of course, a lot as well.
I think there's a real value in pilgrimage, because it gets you into a state where you want to spiritualize your whole journey. And in Europe, my favorite pilgrimage spot was always Assisi. That was always a place where I really felt the presence of Saint Francis and Jesus. And yeah, I feel like here in California, we are very blessed with places that have been followed by Yogananda. So even sometimes when I'm in downtown LA, I feel like, let's go to the Biltmore Hotel lobby and just sit there for a bit. And it's just so great, because it is a very powerful vibration that he left in many places there.
It's true. Yeah, I felt that as well when I was in America, because I went to, well, you three already know, but I went to Mother Center, and then I journeyed down to Encinitas and visited there, and me and Mike went to a few spots, Lake Shrine, and what do they actually Forest call Lawn. That? Is it the crypt? Is that what
yeah,
it's
Forest
called?
Forest Lawn is the name of the cemetery, and yeah, his crypt is there.
Yeah, and there's such a power in these places, and you find it in the smallest spots as well, you know. I remember sitting in Encinitas, there's a little bench that looks out right over the ocean, and it's got this very strong sort of presence to it. And someone remarked to me as I was sitting there, oh, Guruji used to sit there. there you go. That'll be it. So yeah, there's definitely a very great power. I just want to touch on as well the person's name who I'm having trouble pronouncing, Shankaracharya. We will cover more on that in the next episode, because there's a beautifully long footnote. So we're going to delve into that next time. Okay, so then the chapter continues, and we have a very tense talk now between Sri Yukteswar and Guruji. And, you know, we've had this sort of very beautiful, soft, tender moment, and now it switches. And Sri Yukteswar says, you will come to me in 4 weeks. And then it says that his voice was stern for the first time. And it's quite interesting, this 4 weeks thing, isn't it? it seems that, you know, it's that prediction, isn't it? It's like this is happening. And then he says, you know, that now that I've told you of my eternal affection and have shown my happiness at finding you, you feel free to disregard my request. Which I found quite a peculiar choice of words, the word request, because it feels like a statement. It feels like he's not really asking him. It doesn't even feel like he's telling him. It just feels like this is what's going to happen. What did you make of it, Priyank?
Yeah, there's a couple, definitely I agree with you. The other thing I was going to say was that, you know, perhaps Mukunda is a bit taken aback by his stern voice. You know, he feels the need to mention this, you know, his tone all these years ago that he must have remembered. And no doubt he obviously also reflected that that was the first of many, many stern conversations that Sri Yukteswar had with him. But the other point I was going to say was that it suddenly turns a little bit bitter, not bitter, but, you know, stern, because up to now they've had such a lovely fellowship, right? This reunion. And now this just takes a slightly darker turn in terms of the seriousness and the gravity of the words being exchanged. So the bittersweet parallel duality of life is kind of reflected here as well.
Yeah, when he said that for the first time his voice was stern, when I read that I thought, well, he's switched gear, you know, fairly firmly. He hasn't kept sort of gradually got to this point or anything. He hasn't preluded this conversation with anything, it seems. And I thought, wow, okay, that's, you know, he's making a point. There's something here that he's trying to communicate. And to me, obviously, reading on, what was being ingrained in my mind was that he knew that there is much in Guruji at this stage of his development that he needed to help him work through. So this was kind of the preempt of that, like, you know, this is going to be tough work. There's cut the nonsense sort of thing. There's no rebellious nature. You've got to put the work in now. So it was sort of the firmness that was going to be needed, as Guruji later describes as almost like pulling teeth, you know, the nature of the discipline that we would have to go through. So yeah, this is the first warning in a sense.
I think he also notices that this request is a tough one and it might take some time to process for Mukunda. That's why he kind of says, okay, at the end of the day, you cannot disregard what I say. So sooner or later, you have to go home.
Yeah, we see a few lines down that he basically reads the mind of Guruji. He knows what's going on. So he preempts exactly what he's thinking or, you know, struggling with. So he probably says it in mind of that. Like he's already trying to get ahead of the conversation.
Is it me, or is there also a bit of a touch of humor to how he's worded it, in the sense that I've showered you with my unconditional love, essentially giving you one of the most beautiful experiences of your life, and now you're disregarding the one thing that I'm asking you to, and it's not like I'm asking you to move a mountain, really. It's just the
just go home. No,
go home from whence you came.
Yeah, off to a rocky start.
Yeah, but before we get there, just before we do, Sri Yukteswar then goes on to say that next time that they meet, Guruji's going to have to reawaken his interest, and that he's not going to accept him easily as a disciple. And yeah, Mike.
That also means he foresees next time. So he's pretty sure that, I don't know if you ever come across people who kind of are very emotionally intelligent and they kind of know what's going to happen, and you just argue with them and then they already tell you, see, next time you will have to do it like this. And I feel like that's what Priyatesh was doing here.
Yeah, he's saying that you shall have to reawaken my interest. So he's saying this to Guruji to say that I'm not necessarily going to simply accept you as my disciple. So this is the stark warning. If the previous comment of you will come to me in 4 weeks in a stern way wasn't a shot across the bow, so to speak, this was definitely the warning that Guruji probably needed to hear at that time to refocus his mind on what's important.
And because Guruji is then has gone against the wishes of Sri Yukteswar, kind of going against the grain, whenever one does that and it's for one of your higher endeavors spiritually, you have to reap what you sow, right? You have to suffer some of those consequences to rebuild that where you were or where you should have gone. So Sri Yukteswar is essentially confirming that, isn't he? He's saying you'll have to reawaken my interest. This lovely moment that we've just shared isn't just going to come so easily next time. And he says, I won't easily accept you as a disciple. Tough words, isn't it, to hear after, especially such a moving moment as it was in the previous few paragraphs.
I don't know if you guys were surprised by the Guruji's Mukunda's demeanor here, but I was thinking, oh, he finally found his guru after lifelong search, and then he lets this little thing get in the way. But maybe that's also showing how strong Maya can be. But I was surprised by that this was allowed to happen.
Is it something similar to the vein where Sri Yukteswar has his Asamadhi and then appears before Yogananda, and when he does, Yogananda sort of bear hugs him, doesn't want to let him go? Whereas that's not the nature of what's happening in that moment. He has to go. And so Yogananda is sort of fighting this. He wants to actually be with him. He doesn't want to leave him. He doesn't want to go, and wants to just probably be stuck to Sri Yukteswar from day one and never let him go. Maybe it could be something along that nature as well.
Yeah. And it's like you said, Brian, like it must have been quite hard to hear, mustn't it? In that instance, like they've just had this lovely moment, and then it's like, well, next time you see me, you're going to have to try and get my interest. And it's quite stark, isn't it? And I read in the Divine Romance this line from Guruji, and it says, great saints don't waste their time. You have to convince them of the urgency of your heart. And I really love that. And I feel like it's very helpful, actually, for me, just in general. I can approach meditations like that, and so on and so forth. But anyway, Sri Yukteswar then goes on to say that Guruji must have complete surrender by obedience to my strict training. And there's such a vast topic on this, isn't there? Obedience to the guru, and what does that look like? And actually, it's perhaps even different for all of us what obedience to our guru is like, and how that is for us in our lives. But there are some wonderful things that Guruji has written about this. But before we do, Priyank, what
would you like to say? These two things. One is the fact that he's now directly saying that he's going to have be strict. So the cats, if it wasn't out of the bag with the suggestion previously, now it's, confirmed, stamped, sealed, and delivered that how life is going to be for Mukunda for the next 10 years that he was with Sri Yukteswar. And also the obedience comment, Lauren, you made about it's different for all of us. Yeah, it's definitely true. For me, I just like to stick to obedience in terms of being regular with my practices, and just try and stick true to the teachings and the guidance that he gives us as much as I can. But more than the guidance, I just try and let the practice you know, evolve my, you know, how I live my life, as opposed to like making every single thing, making a list of, you know, the advice that every guru says in every walk of my life and being obedient with all of those. Because I think that's quite a challenge to do that, because he's given advice on so, like, virtually every facet of your life, you know, from how to attract a soulmate to how to attract true friends to how to be in, you know, in life and work and service. It's like such a vast topic, but doing your practices and being regular with those and going deeper and deeper meditation, I feel like all the rest will kind of hopefully come out of that.
Yeah, I actually read this beautiful line by Sri Yukteswar in the Holy Science the other night, and he was saying about when we do our practices, to do it out of love for our guru. And that really stayed with me, and it just came to mind when you were talking about that, Priyank. Yeah, it's true. Mike.
One thing that I kept thinking about was always like, why did he join Dayananda's ashram and stay there for so long? And one reason could also be that now he's more ready to join Sri Yukteswar because he learned obedience there already, and gotten used to some kind of ashram discipline and life. So this might have moved him to the next level in that sense.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Like, everything's a stepping stone, even if we don't necessarily see it in that moment. Yeah, and I was thinking about this whole obedience to the guru and how, you know, sometimes maybe it feels kind of far away for some people, or even us in moments, you know, if, you know, well, Guruji's not here in his physical body, but he is here everywhere all the time, right? But I found some things I thought might be helpful to us or anyone that's listening, perhaps for attuning ourselves with Guruji, because he is really omnipresent and always here, as close to us as we are ourselves. So Chris, would you mind reading this out, please?
Sure. I receive the vibrations of my guru Sri Yukteswar all the time, even though he is now reborn on another plane. When he was still living in India, I used to feel his vibration. So it is true that you can receive the magnetism of saints even from a great distance, because it is so powerful.
And then I found this next thing that Guruji says, and he says, while you are praying, visualize that I am praying with you, and you will feel a great reinforcement of power.
And the advice related to that we're given is to never meditate alone, isn't it? I, at the start of each meditation, invoke the presence of each of our six gurus and bring them round the circle and meditate with them.
And it's very helpful, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so back to the chapter. So we've just had this sort of very direct, straightforward remark from Sri Yukteswar. And I would sort of assume or think, you know, oh wow, okay, he'll just say yes, sure, absolutely, I'll come in to you in 4 weeks, whatever you say. But Lord Mukunda just stays silent, and it is obstinately silent as well. And he says that his guru penetrated his difficulty, and he gets straight to the heart of it in full Sri Yukteswar style, and says, do you think your relatives will laugh at you? And really, that's what the heart of it is, isn't it? That, you know, poor Mukunda, he's had all this all these remarks from his family about going away and going to the ashram, and that he's going to be back soon, and Ananta's, you know, sort of really gone to town on him, hasn't he, for his desire. And then Guruji says, "I will not return." You can imagine, you can sort of feel the tension and the atmosphere in this when you read it. It's like you cut through it with a knife. And then Sri Yukteswar goes back in and retorts, "You will return in 30 days." And Guruji says, "Never." And it's just so sort of... Chris, what do you make of this?
You know, it's shocking, actually, or it's surprising. I don't know which is the better adjective for it. But in a way, it's not. It's sort of true to form to Guruji that he has been very rebellious in many different ways in his childhood. He's been very independent. He's been the leader. He's been the one to sort of make decisions and go out there and do things. And so this instruction is very much against his own desire, his own kind of mind, that he had set his mind to doing something. And here it is, just, you know, at the drop of a hat, say, nope, you've got to change that and go back. And I think he had had it so firmly in his mind to not return under any circumstance, almost, that it's not surprising to me that he wasn't willing to change his mind that quickly. So change your mind slowly and make up your mind slowly. But once it's done, it's done. So that to me is this sign of Guruji, that his mental power is so strong that he was sort of caught up in that a little bit in this moment and wasn't willing to change it so quickly. But I think that is both an incredible strength of his that we can all learn from. But in this case, it's getting in the way of the flow of life.
I feel like the intensity is underlined here even more by, he says, "Never," but then he also says, "I bowed reverently at his feet and departed." So it's basically like never, and he was out the door. So this was a real, I don't want to say argument, but it was a real disagreement. And if this happens in real life, you would think, I don't know if this gets resolved, but somehow Sri Yukteswar has no doubt he will return, and Guruji, we'll see. I mean, it's not, people probably know what will happen, but it is, it probably, Guruji needs some time to think through, let's put it that way.
And he walks in the midnight darkness, he says, yeah, here, towards the ashram. So you can just imagine him sort of wandering home, sort of ruminating on this event.
We do know that there is a positive ending to this whole interaction, you know, spoiler alert, but it does sort of serve as a warning not to have this great strength of a firm mind. You know, once you put your mind to something, you know, you can actually create it and go out there and create that reality, not to let that get in the way of what we should be doing, which is having faith and having trust in our guru. So not letting your own mind try to figure things out for itself, but actually put the faith into a higher power. Because even Guruji in this moment is showing us that it's possible. And imagine what would have happened if he actually had stuck to that and it actually put a wall between them. Could you imagine? So thank God that he didn't, but it serves as a bit of a warning to me, or a lesson.
Essentially, don't be your worst enemy. Your own worst enemy is the moral, isn't it? Here, as Mike said, that he, you know, the controversy was relieved, but before he left, he still bowed reverently. So he didn't lose himself, I suppose, or his newly established relationship with his guru, and just walk away, kind of, you know, without doing the necessary respect and obeisances that you need to show towards your guru, which is quite comforting, isn't it? But the other good thing here is that I said that he was walking in the midnight darkness towards the ashram. So that's 12 hours. Because we knew that when he he said that the sun had not quite reached its zenith or something, and when we're talking about what time he met Sri Yukteswara, so it must have been around midday, and now we're talking about midnight. So Guruji's just records just not that many words here in this whole conversation, but that's 12 hours of conversations. But we do know that they had, you know, they had quite a probably very long sounding meditation amidst all of this trauma and troubles.
So assuming then most of the meeting was harmonious, it was just this little conversation actually at the end which kind of turned the tables, and yeah,
but I feel like in human interaction that such an end like this can somehow make all the difference, right? It can make you you have hours of pleasant conversation and then 5 minutes of inharmonious discourse, and suddenly the whole thing was bad, right? So I wonder if Guruji, he said he was thinking about why it ended like this, and like for me, when I would have left on this note, I would have my mind would have been in uproar. My mind would have been, oh, what's going on here? And it must have been the same for him, because he, on the one hand, he went from the highest high to, I don't want to say the lowest low, but from the highest high to some disappointing ending, let's say it like that.
Yeah, and he describes it as the dual scales of Maya that balance every joy with a grief. That's quite something, isn't it, actually, to think that every joy comes with a grief. Gosh.
Yeah. He was, as Mike said, that he was, at that time, he was probably wondering why it was in, you know, it ended on an inharmonious note during that walk. But he answers his own wondering there, i.e. the dual scales of Maya that balance every joy with grief. And I wonder if that reflection was one that he had, you know, 30 years later, after he was a Paramahansa Yogananda, rather than Mukunda, thinking about this meeting, because it feels like this, he may have thought about the meaning of this interaction and what actually happened, what it actually means, and how it reflects life by the dual scales of Maya. That balance every joy with grief. And we know that he had a very, very beautifully joyous moment in the initial moments of the meeting, and for the first 11 hours and 50 minutes of that meeting, for the 10 minutes of grief.
I actually feel like there's a definite truth to what you just said there, Priyank, about that sentence about Maya being a reflection. I think perhaps yes, because then the next line, Guruji says, my young heart was not yet malleable to the transforming fingers of my guru, which is definitely a reflection, isn't it? So, yeah, it does feel like it's kind of a reflective lesson learned.
Yeah, maybe does that attract what I said about the mind earlier? It's actually about his heart. He doesn't mention that his mind is the thing holding him back. So maybe it was pride or something that exists emotionally in the heart might have been stopping him from returning to his family rather than his mind.
Yeah. Sri Yukteswara talks a lot about the heart, doesn't he, and the holy science and things like that. So there's a lot that comes from the heart.
The stages of the heart.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, yeah. But that could be a whole other podcast, the holy science. we won't go there today, just in case we fall into the rabbit hole of divinity and never return. And then the chapter kind of takes a little turn now. And so Guruji's gone back to the hermitage where he's staying. And suddenly the hostility increases, not kind of shockingly, I have to say, on reflection. And he says that, you know, they spiked my days with invariable rudeness. So he really had to endure some, you know, trials, didn't he, and not lose his peace amidst it all.
I think that because now the direction of his life is set, isn't it? In terms of Srikrishna is his present and future. So now the world is like, if you stay on that path that you're not supposed to be on, there's a whole host of resistance, isn't there? And it just gets worse and worse until you finally follow the course that you know you're meant to be taking. And here we see that it was really bad, invariable rudeness and increased hostility. So that was bound to happen. And, you know, for us, that's often painful as well when we go against the direction that we need to go in, or if we insist on, for example, keeping the company that we know we shouldn't be keeping, then relationships sometimes get worse and worse until you finally, you know, pull the plug and follow the direction that you're meant to be following.
Like Priyank said, now he knows what he wants, and he knows that his future is not in this ashram. So I guess the perspective changes for him. Before, he thought, this might be my future living here, so I need to find arrangements. And now it's much easier for him to draw the line and draw boundaries around himself. And maybe that probably sparked the situation to deteriorate over there, I imagine, and leads to his departure from there eventually.
Yeah, that as well as the fact that the day before he was with Habu, and he had Habu's probably went back and said, Mukunda, you know, he kind of was with me and then he wasn't, and he ran off.
Useless. Yeah.
There's no understanding there, but Yogananda doesn't reflect and say, well, I went back and explained everything.
Yeah, I wonder if he did utter a word. Probably not. I mean, what would you even say?
She's probably absolutely introspective, you know, trying to figure things out and thinking about the inharmonious way it ended and things like this, that he probably hasn't said anything, right? You know, he's probably just went back and kept his head down, not bothered explaining about the leg situations, as you know. So he's probably left a lot of questions amongst the team, and he's maybe distanced himself even further. He doesn't go into these details, right? But we can imagine it.
Yeah, little bit from Habu's perspective, though. You'd be justified in making things a bit more difficult for Mukunda. You're walking along, you've got this chore to do, and Mukunda's like, his legs are being weird and he's looking around. He just gives you all the heavy goods that you're supposed to take back to the ashram together, and then doesn't come back for 12 hours. He's probably, maybe he's even his, like, he's in his roommate. So he's like, he goes home, does all the work that they were supposed to do together, and then goes home, and he's not come home at 6, not come home at 9, comes home crawling into bed past midnight. It's not a good thoughts from young poor Habu's head.
And it's just saying, you'll not believe me, and they don't, you know. he's just trying to get out of the shopping.
Yeah, and like I have to say, I did find it a kind of a bit sad that he had to endure so much rudeness and hostility, and you know, he says it 3 weeks passed, so again, like, that's a long time to kind of retain like a level of decorum under such like intense rudeness. But I have to say, even though I did feel a bit sad of thinking of poor little Mukunda, you know, enduring all of this, like, he did have to go through it to be with his guru. So really, it's a joy, really, that it happened. But yeah, it must have been quite a test at the time.
Yes, to suffer the pain of disregarding his guru's requirements, shall we say. But I was wondering, 3 weeks potentially may have passed because he was waiting for his next like paycheck from his dad, because he has to go from Benares back to Calcutta, right? And you can't just magically, it's not a short journey. Even now you drive and it's probably like 12 hours, having done it actually in the last few weeks. So he's probably has to pick his moment. You can't just say I'm out of here. Just to play it cool for a little while and bear all this pain.
Yeah, especially with technology back then, he would probably have to send a telegram to his dad or something. I don't know. And then I don't know how you send money to, I don't even know how that works. Does the cash come in the mail or is it
Western Union, Mike?
It was Western Union. Was it already there? All right.
West Bengal Union.
West Bengal Union. Also, we shouldn't forget that he left Triyukteswar on this note where he said, "I will never return." Right. So, I don't know if it took him 3 weeks to change his mind on that, but he was. It might have taken some time to. Let this all settle.
There's a lesson in here somewhere as well about company. Frank mentioned it, touched on it a little bit there about the company that you keep. And sometimes it does go this way, you know, if you're not in the right company. I think it's a pretty great lesson. And it's something that if all younger people would learn, you know, in their teens, maybe, or you know, maybe even earlier if possible, it would save a lot of heartache. You know, it's not really into your 20s and 30s you sort of realize, you know, who it is that you are and want to be, etc. But even the great successful Yogananda, we know that he goes on to do what he does and to be who he goes on to be. He has these moments where he's trying to sort of fit into a world that isn't right for him. So I think everybody could relate to that in some way, right? So, it's a drama. It's hurtful, but you can still go on to find your family, your soul family. Like, I think everybody feels, people in SRF, like we're soul brothers and sisters in a way. It's one big family. And Yogananda goes on to create that for himself. Like, it's such a nice ending to this difficult time that he's going through.
Yeah, and it's so helpful. Like, I know it definitely helped me and continues to, but particularly in the early days, you know, I didn't know anyone that was, you know, even close to this path apart from other SRF devotees, and just being around being on this podcast with you all, and like all of it really does make such a difference, and it's such a blessing to have like-minded friends. You know, so yeah, the opposite is, well, pandemonium, as we're about to find out from Guruji. So apparently 3 weeks pass, you know, he's been through all these trials, and then Dayananda leaves the ashram because he has to go to a conference in Bombay, and Guruji says, "Pandemonium broke over my hapless head." I had a little giggle at this line. I don't know why. There's just something comedic about the way he writes it, not necessarily the actual happening. But then comes this really horrible remark. Well, I found it horrible, that he overhears saying, "Mukunda is a parasite, accepting hermitage hospitality without making proper return." It's very strong, isn't it? And like, also, what would be a proper return? What constitutes that? And yeah, it's quite something.
I think it shows a bit the dynamic in the ashram, that when Dayananda was there, it was much nicer for Mukunda, because Dayananda really appreciated Mukunda, it seems. And then when he left, then the other ashram members, they did not appreciate him as much, and they did not see the value he brings, which probably was more of a of a spiritual upliftment rather than doing it, all the chores all the time that he supposed to do.
And it's kind of, it made me reflect, like, you know, how if Dayananda leaves and then people's approaches to Guruji are changing, then, you know, that it kind of says where they're at, doesn't it, on their journey. Mike?
That also shows the kind of living in an ashram. Like Guruji said, life should be chiefly service. And I think that there's some real, like, wisdom in this, because if you live in an ashram and everything is just an exchange, you exchange service for food, you exchange service for someone else's service, then this becomes a zero-sum game and a race to the bottom. But if you do service for God, if you serve your other members of the ashram because you want to please God, then this becomes a very joyous experience living in an ashram.
And also, I guess it's another little nod that, you know, going to the ashram is only well and good if you've really removed all those qualities within you that aren't conducive to the spiritual path, because otherwise you just end up like here in an ashram full of bitter devotees who are being really mean, you know. So so with that, he regrets sending his money back to his father, he says, as you would. And he says, with a heavy heart, he seeks out his only friend, Jitendra. Jitendra to the rescue. I really like their friendship. I find it very sweet.
Yeah, I think let's stretch out this keeping the right company lesson even more here, because in times of trouble, such as what Mukunda is experiencing now and what we experience, isn't it absolutely wonderful to have a Jitendra in our lives when we go through our hardships? And that's why, you know, it is great to have great like-minded friends and relationships, and that's why company can be both a a hindrance, or that, you know, can create trouble for your life, but also it can be the opposite, which is it supports your life and spiritual endeavors. And not even, they don't even need to be spiritual necessarily. They can be anything, can't they? Even, you know, family and work and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it makes a massive difference. It's a blessing, isn't it, having friends like that. So he goes to his friend and he says, I'm leaving. And he asks him to convey his respectful regrets to Dayanandaji when he comes back. And in true friend form, Jitendra goes, well, I will leave also. And he's not just because Mukunda's leaving. He says that, you know, his attempts to meditate aren't, you know, meeting with any more favor than his own. So apparently he's very determined about this as well, that he was going as well, which is probably a boost to Mukunda as well, thinking, yes, power in numbers. Yeah, Mike.
Do you guys find it funny that they choose to wait for Dayananda to leave, to actually leave the ashram? Do you think that's also maybe Dayananda was such a charming old chap that they couldn't do it to him, so they had to wait until he goes traveling before they leave? Maybe that's also a reason for the 3 weeks.
No guilt.
It must have been really bad, mustn't it, for them to leave, but also, you know, given Mukunda's strong determination not to go home, but also for them to leave while Dayanandaji isn't there. Like, think the person that is really kind of brought you to this place and who you really enjoy spending time with, and, you know, he has such respect for Dayanandaji, doesn't he? And to leave them without even saying goodbye, like, that's huge, isn't it? And so it must have been really terrible. It must have really got to a point where they just went, no, I'm out of here. which they did. And Guruji then shares with Jitendra that he says, "I have met a Christ-like saint. Let us visit him in Sarampur." Mike.
I found that the way he said it interesting, because I don't know what the reputation of Christ is in West Bengal or in Benares, or if people are impressed if they hear that, or if they, but he used it there, and I don't know if he actually used it in his native language or if it's just the translation for the book here.
Yeah, we guess we can never know that. my impression would be that Christ-like is a translation of a word like a sadguru, which is, you know, someone who's a true guru or something like along those lines. But this is all, you'll also remember that this was in the second paragraph where he said, of the book, where he said, "My own path led me to a Christ-like sage." And now, after 10 chapters of slogging through this autobiography, we get a confirmation of this first, you know, page, second paragraph line.
And he doesn't tell Jitendra, "Oh, I've met my guru, you know, we've just confessed our unconditional love for one another." It's just, he's not downplaying it, because a Christ-like saint is huge, but he's kind of shrouding that divine encounter in this language. And we talked on this before, didn't we, of, you know, not necessarily sharing our spiritual experiences and so on and so forth. And I feel like this kind of, it gives enough to his friend to convince him to go, and also intrigue him that he might also want to meet him, but doesn't fully like disclose the depth of their relationship. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, probably in line with some of Yogananda's previous adventures, you know, the beginnings of them. I don't know, when I read this, I thought it was quite reserved as well. I thought, you know, maybe there's, for the sake of writing the book, you kind of leave out certain things that are said, you just summarize it in some way, as he's maybe done here. He's said it in one sentence, you know, I imagine more was said. But if there wasn't more said, maybe he was a bit cautious about the trials that were still yet to come, that the Shore had warned him about, like, "Hey, I'm not just going to accept you this time. Surrender to me." So maybe he was still in this agitated state because of what was going on in the ashram where he was, possibly. It's curious to think about, really, isn't it, that he didn't just say, "This is my guru, you know, he's going to be my guru," and kind of go in more heavy in the description.
And I'm still hung up about the way they parted. You know, he says never, and he left the building, right? But Sri Yukteswar said you will return in 30 days, so that's also kind of a hidden, you're welcome to return in 30 days, right? You're always welcome to come back. And he doesn't feel that same feeling that he has with his family, that Sri Yukteswar will wait for him and say, like, well, look who's back. Like, he's not going to be like that. He's not going to be like that. He's, he knows that Mukunda, that is like a really difficult thing for him to go back to his family, but eventually he will get over it. And maybe that's why he's a bit cautious in describing this here.
And I'm just wondering also, if that's why Sri Yukteswar said, "I will not easily accept you as my disciple," mm-hmm. because he knows that Mukunda's going to resist his request. And, you know, they're going to have this conversation of, you know, "No, I'm not going back." So it kind of all makes sense, mm-hmm. doesn't it, really? But alas, as we read in the last sentence of the chapter, "So the bird prepared to swoop perilously close to Calcutta." So it's all about to come true, as we won't be surprised to read.
I love the bird analogy that stems from banter between him and Ananta. It's just, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it ends the chapter on kind of like an uplifting note, you know, and it ends with an exclamation mark as well. So it feels like, oh, you know, we're about to get into something. So even with all this sort of supposed inharmoniousness, we get a kind of an uplifting end, which I quite enjoy. But it's
like
not
a cliffhanger, isn't it?
It is actually. It is very much like a cliffhanger because I feel like, oh, what happens next? You know, which we will find out. Yeah, Mike.
Did you guys ever think that the arrangement at Shriyukteswar's could have been done differently? That somehow Shriyukteswar could have said, oh, you can stay in my hermitage with me. But he didn't do that because he felt that Guruji has some things to work through with his family, and that will be part of his training. So I'm choosing to do it like that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Mike. Yeah, there's so many things that they would have known, isn't there? That, you know, only on reflection or when we read the book, we think, oh yeah, there's a lesson in there. But that's not quite the end of the chapter, because we, like I said earlier, we have a lovely long footnote, which we're going to delve into next episode. So we look forward to that, unless anyone has anything else they want to add about this chapter. No, we will end it here on the joyous note of the bird swooping close to Calcutta, and we'll find out more in the next chapter. Thank you all so much. It's been such a joy, this episode. So thank you. And we'll meet next time. Take care.
Thank you.